listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight's panel, Three Approaches to Writing Biography, features three brilliant writers, Casey Cole, Barbara Eisenberg, Kenneth Turan, and three larger-than-life subjects, Frank Oppenheimer, Frank Gehry, and Joe Papp. One might bear in mind a principal tip that comes up on many biography writing tips websites for high school students. No biography is or can be the full, unvarnished story of a life. So I thought that was very succinct. We will learn tonight perhaps what these three biographers decided to include, what they left on the cutting room floor. We'll explore the creative process, the strategies, and the eventual outcome of each of these three labor-intensive endeavors. Our writers, Casey Cole, Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens, Frank Oppenheimer and the World He Made Up, is a tale told by a friend and colleague of the subject and was years in the making. Casey Cole is currently on the faculty of the USC Annenberg School of Journalism. Previously, she was science correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and she has written for many other publications. She's the author of seven nonfiction books, including Mind Over Matter, Conversations with the Cosmos, The Hole in the Universe, How Scientists Peered Over the Edge of Emptiness and Found Everything, and The Universe and the Teacup, The Mathematics of Truth and Beauty. She's been honored with numerous prizes, including the American Institute for Physics Science Writing Prize. Barbara Eisenberg is the author, most recently, of Conversations with Frank Gehry, an intimate portrait of one of the world's most influential architects. Barbara is a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times. You might have read her wonderful profile of Alfred Molina recently. She writes for Time Magazine and many other publications. She's been a visiting scholar at the Getty Research Institute and is associate editor of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities at USC. Her books include Making It Big, The Diary of a Broadway Musical, and State of the Arts, California Artists Talk About Their Work. Kenneth Turan's biography, also years in the making, credits his subject as co-author. Free for All, Joe Papp, the Public, and the Greatest Theater Story Ever Told is an oral history of the New York Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater. Kenneth is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure you read him often. And NPR's Morning Edition, as well as the director of the Los Angeles Times Book Prizes, which means he's been very busy recently. He's been a staff writer for the Washington Post and TV Guide and the Times' book review editor. His books include Sundance to Sarajevo, Film Festivals and the World They Made, as well as Never Coming to a Theater Near You and Now in Theaters Everywhere. And our distinguished moderator tonight, Kit Rackless, who will help us make sense of all this, has a distinguished history as a writer and editor. He was the executive editor of The Village Voice, editor-in-chief of the LA Weekly, senior editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine, and that paper's senior projects editor. In 2000, he became the editor-in-chief of Los Angeles. During his tenure, the magazine was nominated for a National Magazine Award 8 times and received more city and regional magazine awards than any other magazine. His writing has appeared in the Rolling Stone, Illustrated History of Rock and Roll, and Stranded Rock and Roll for a Desert Island. So please welcome our panelists, and Kit, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and welcome, everybody. As Louise said, our subject tonight is biography, and our biographers have written three very distinctly different books. Ken Turan has written an oral history in which he interviewed more than 150 people to provide a portrait of Joseph Papp, the great theater impresario. Casey Cole has probably written, at least on the surface, the more traditional of these three books, but in fact it's a personal biography of Frank Oppenheimer, the physicist and the great museum creator, the creator of the Exploratorium in San Francisco, in which she is both participant and observer in the book. And then there's Barbara's book, which is, as Louise explained, is a conversation, albeit a conversation that took over many years, 4 years, 5 years, 20 years? With Frank Gehry, the renowned architect. Now, on the surface, the three subjects could not be more different. There's a theater impresario, there's a scientist, and an architect. But in fact, they have many things in common. They're all first-generation Americans. They belong to that extraordinary wave of Jewish immigrants who profoundly affected American life. Two, Joe Papp and Frank Oppenheimer, were communists, and Frank Gehry grew up, by his own description, in a left-wing milieu, and their politics had profound effects on their lives and on the institutions that they created. All three were transformed by the West Coast. Frank Gehry moved here when he was 17 and discusses quite eloquently about coming to Los Angeles, a place that he described as being free of the burden of history, which I actually think is an extraordinarily accurate statement, and says a lot about the liberation that all three found, or says a lot about the liberation that also Joseph Papp surprisingly also found in Los Angeles. He was here for 9 months after World War II, was a member of the Actors Lab, and discovered there his passion for theater, and also discovered that he was not an actor, but a brilliant organizer, in fact, a brilliant producer. And then there's Frank Oppenheimer, who had been drawn to the West, first Colorado, New Mexico, and the Bay Area since he was a young man. And when he settles in the Bay Area, finds it as a place that is, again, free of not only the burdens of history, but the kind of stuffy confines of a very wealthy milieu in the Upper West Sides of New York. There are also two other things that they have in common. They created institutions that have had profound effects on the cities that they lived in. There probably is no greater and more influential theater organization in the 20th century than the Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater in New York. The Exploratorium in San Francisco is considered by most people as the greatest science museum in the world, and certainly the one that's had the greatest influence on all the other science museums in the world. And we don't have to walk very far to see what kind of influence Frank Gehry has had on Los Angeles. He achieved that rare, rare thing, which is that he instantly created a kind of symbol for the city that transformed not only outsiders' view of Los Angeles, but Angelenos' view of the city themselves. And so we have three very different subjects and three very different approaches. And so I wanted to begin with our panelists about why they took the approach they did. And so I wanted to start with you, Ken, which is, why an oral history?
Well, actually, it's a very simple answer. It was mandated. The project was brought to me as an oral history. Why that? I think Joe liked the idea of having people talking. I think maybe the idea of a formal biography, he didn't want it about him. He wanted it about the theater. And I think he thought that oral history was the best way to go about it. I think he was right, but I didn't have any choice. No one said, well, do you think this will be okay? They said, it's an oral history. Do you want to do it?
Can you talk a little bit before we go on about sort of the history of this book? Which has its own complicated...
I could do it. There should be an oral history of the oral history. As some people might know, I signed the contract for this book in 1986. I did it. I finished it. It sat in a box that used to hold hiking boots, which I still have. I have the boots and the box. Because Joe turned against it for reasons that were never totally clear and decided he didn't want to get it published. And it took a long time for me to kind of bring it back to life. I could talk. We have other people to hear from. I could talk a long time about this, but I'm loath to.
Barbara, talk about how you arrived at doing a conversation with Frank Gehry.
Well, mine actually was brought to me by Frank Gehry, but it wasn't in this form. I ran into Frank Gehry at Disney Hall once. He said, I have a great idea if you want to talk about it. And I said, sure. I called him the next week. I went over there. And he was trying to do an oral history. That was his idea, like a memoir for his archive. And so I said I would help him with that. And after we did it for a while, I had interviewed him for 20 years at that point, so we really knew each other well. And I'd written about him in my last book and for magazines and newspapers. And after we'd been doing it for a while, I said, this is really good. So I think we should make it a conversation, not an oral history. And so he sort of, went, yeah, okay, which is the way he talks. And so the conversation seemed to me the best way to show what he was thinking about and then to pursue it so that it was broken up and it wasn't one long monologue. And it would be focused on him, and there are stage directions in there, which is, in other words, like it'll say, I say in the book, he stood up and went into the other room, or he laughed, or he pulled out some drawing paper and stuff like that. So I took my theater background and put that in. again, I don't want to keep going. It's your turn.
No. It's fascinating.
So, Casey, yours is a very personal book. You knew this subject very well for the last 15, 17 years of Frank Oppenheimer's
life.
Yeah,
but I was dragged kicking and screaming into doing a biography and to putting myself into it.
You were asked to do an oral history?
No. Nobody wanted me to do anything with it. I wanted to collect his papers, which he started giving me in the early 1980s, and were full of these fascinating ideas about science and invention and aesthetics and all kinds of things, and nobody had any interest in it. And finally, I got a contract, but they wanted me to do a biography, and I really sort of panicked. I didn't know how. I had to rely on friends. And as for putting myself in it, which was part of it, as I began to do the archival, which I'd never done. I mean, this was completely, I'm a journalist. I'm not used to sitting in libraries for, you know, months and looking at letters and writing to the FBI, which turned out to be remarkably easy. I mean, they just gave me everything.
They blacked out a lot of things.
Yeah, they blacked out a lot of things. That's right. But the main thing was, so I was having a conversation with a friend in New York, actually, who was guiding me through the finding aid of Frank Oppenheimer's papers at the Bancroft Library. And there's Hans Bethe, the great physicist, bunch of letters. And on the other side, there's George Gamow, who came up with the Big Bang, another. And then in the middle, there's Casey Cole. And there are three folders of letters. So it was like looking at myself at age 26, you know, and discovering science and discovering. So I had to be in it.
So, all right, so this is how you arrived at it. So what were the kind of advantages of doing an oral history, and what were the limitations you ran up against?
Well, I like the form. I don't know that I would do it again because, as you said, it was awfully time and labor intensive. But, you know, I really believe in voice, in people's individual voices. Even though I work as a film critic now, I have a long background as a journalist interviewing people. And it's just really exciting to bring people's voices alive, to put on paper what they sound like. And with all these different people, it was really exciting to bring them all to life, to have every single person sound individual. And I really started to feel, I mean, there's been a standard biography of Joe written, which doesn't capture the richness and the excitement of that period in these people. And I think the oral history was really a great way to bring people alive so that people could actually feel that they're listening to the stories right as they're being told. What you lose is that you can't really, I mean, obviously you have some control, you know, you're deciding what goes where. You don't totally lose control. But, you know, you can't write your own stuff. You can't write, you know, interweaving stuff. You use your own voice as a writer is missing. And I miss that at times, but I think it was much more worth it. I mean, I'm very happy it turned out this way. If I had to do it all over again, I'd do it the same way.
24 years?
Well, I wouldn't want the 24 years, but I do like the oral history format. I think it, if done correctly, it's really exciting in a way that I don't think anything else is.
And Barbara, what were the strengths in your mind and the limitations of the conversation, of doing a conversation?
Well, can I go back and refer to what Kenny said?
Sure, please.
Ken said for a moment. because when I was reading your book, I loved hearing all those individual voices. And like Martin Sheen, for example, told some wonderful stories. And it was just, it was great to have the conversation that he would... There'd be, like, say, Sheen's conversation, and then somebody else would talk about that, and then somebody else would talk about the two of them. And it was very intellectually exciting to kind of put all those conversations together.
Yeah, right? Well, that was, I'm glad you felt that way, because that's what I was hoping would happen.
Yeah.
Okay, yours, Barbara, though, is, you know, in some ways the opposite, which is there are two voices, and there's this pure voice of Frank Gehry all the way through.
What you don't know, unless you've read the acknowledgments really carefully, which most people don't, but
so there's lots of sourcing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I interviewed probably 20 or 30 people, and so sometimes I would ask him a question, and I would say, "So and so, who was on your staff, you know, said that you," or like, "Oh, the architect Michael Maltzen, for instance, had told me that Gehry likes to sit in his chair and just stew." So I, you know, before and to, when he's thinking about which way to go on something, so I said in the book, Michael Maltzen says that you like to sit in your chair and stew. And then, you know, it'd be a way of kind of moving in and bringing in another person. Or some of the people he worked with in the early years. But it is a limited form because it's just the two of us. But I thought it was very exciting because I could keep at him. I could say, and then what? And then what? And are you kidding? You know, stuff like that. So that was...
which. And did you? What did you find in terms of the limits of the strengths and limits of doing a deeply personal biography?
Yeah, I was hoping you would just ask for the limits. The strengths are kind of hard to. It was really hard because this was writing about someone I knew really well, and it was hard to get out of being a journalist and trying to be objective. So it took a long time to decide, okay, I'm just going to write about the Frank I knew and then fill in as much background as was necessary to make that person come alive. But it was really hard to do that because it wasn't balanced. I mean, most people really just did think he was, you know, the most influential person they'd ever met. But I finally remembered something that John Barth had written in the introduction to The Floating Opera, which is one of my favorite novels, which I used to explain what I did. In The Floating Opera, you sit on the bank and there's a boat that goes by and there's an opera and you hear little pieces of the story and then it goes down and you hear it faintly and then you don't hear it at all and then you hear the gossip from the people along the bank and then it comes back and you hear a little more. And I said, well, that's what my book was like. It was what I knew plus rumors and things I got, but it was definitely from me. It was definitely... That was really hard to do for a journalist, I thought.
I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of authorial voice, which each of you have very different voices in these books. And in Barbara's, yours is about as naked as a writer could possibly be. You know, I assume you edited yourself some, but it's not a writerly voice. It is your conversational voice on those pages. What did it, you know, so that you are very much a character in this book. You're the character who was prodding Frank Gehry. How did you think about that? How much did you shape that? How much did you actually edit yourself? All of those things.
Oh, I never edited a word of myself.
I've stumped you. This is so great.
No, you haven't. I'm just sort of kind of trying to think about it. But it struck me that I wanted to show how I was guiding what he was saying. Because if most of the time, all of us are journalists, and you write something and you have a comment from someone, but the question isn't there. And a lot of times, I, as a journalist, when I'm interviewing someone who's been interviewed a lot, I'll go back and I'll see what they've said in the past, and I know what the questions are. They got that response, but the average reader probably doesn't. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun to throw the questions in? And then you could also see when he said something that just didn't make sense, I would say, could you, you know, explain that a little more? Or I would take it out. Because if sometimes there's a section in there when he's talking about the Interactive Corp building in New York, and he was explaining how the different, how the light hit it and how, and all these little things, I forget the word for them, it's some technical term, how that all worked. And I thought, well, if I don't understand it, the reader won't. So I just took it all out and changed the nature of that conversation.
And Ken, in your case, your voice is almost completely absent in the book. It's in the introduction and the afterword, but you don't write under Stieces, you don't do any connecting sort of tissues. You know, your voice is the ghost voice, which is that you're the person who edited this oral history, moved them around, juxtaposed things. But you're which is very different from being a film critic, for instance.
Yeah, it's totally different. The Hidden Hand. There's a book by Carol John Daly called The Hidden Hand. You know, and I was like The Hidden Hand. Well, I liked that because it was so different. It was a challenge. I mean, it was a different way of writing, a different thing to do. It was very exciting because I hadn't done it before and because I had to get the effects I wanted just using what people said. I couldn't write around anything. I couldn't do, as you say, you know, interstitial material to make it clear. All I had was what other people had said, and I had to put that together in a way that made sense. And that was challenging, so I liked that, actually.
And Casey, you too are a character, and you're very much a character in this biography. I mean, so what was it like to sort of be writing about yourself, writing about Frank Oppenheimer?
It was really hard. I mean, I really did have to be pushed into it. But once I got it, it became really freeing and fun. I had a lot of friends help me, my board of advisors, to say, really saying to me, you know, you're always talking about Frank. You're always telling Frank stories. That what you want to do is tell the stories. So once I got that freed, it was also a matter of having a structure, which was very difficult for this book. This is like the fifth draft that actually got to be the book. But I had this brilliant editor, Jane Isay, in New York, who said, you know, this is The Wizard of Oz. I said, The Wizard of Oz? She said, yeah, the beginning is black and white, where he builds the atomic bomb as part of that and is a communist and is exiled and so forth. And then he springs forth into blossom and full bloom. Once that was taken care of, then it was just like the sensors went off and I was just allowed to tell stories. And
well, one of the things that biographers have and all historians and journalists have to deal with, which is conflicting stories and conflicting points of view. And one of the wonderful things about your book, Ken, is that you let very different points of view and very different recollections go crashing up against each other. I mean, there's a wonderful moment, I think, in the story about A Chorus Line where three different people all claim credit for the same key moment. Yeah, and you, yeah. And there's also a wonderful moment late in the book where, you know, both Joe Papp and his wife claim credit for exactly the same moment for saving a normal harder. I can't remember which play it is. So yours is sort of naked. Yours, in a way, whatever conflicts are sort of absent in your book, and you try to resolve them. So very different approaches. Could you talk about why, you know, how you thought about that, how you tried to resolve that, or in your case, not resolve it?
Well, it was a conscious decision not to resolve them because I felt it was just not possible to resolve them, especially without the ability to write my own paragraphs and say, well, this is mostly right, but maybe there's something here. Again, I was stuck with what the people had said. And I finally came to feel, and I think the book kind of makes this happen, that seeing these different people conflict actually says something in and of itself.
Right.
You see what it was like then. You see the way people interact. You see that kind of theatrical process. And I felt it was a good thing that they didn't all agree. And also I felt that kind of with most of those things, if you read all the disagreeing sections, you could really figure out what probably happened, right. You know, which I thought was very interesting. You say, okay, it probably went a little bit like this, a little bit like that. So I felt that in some way they actually, even though they seem to be clashing, they actually fit together in this kind of really fascinating way.
But Casey, in your case, you had to resolve all sorts of different points of view.
Sort of, but again, in the beginning of the book, I use a Frank story. When he was a good friend of Muriel Rukeyser, the poet, and when she died, somebody wanted to write her biography, and they sent him this long questionnaire. Was she smart? Was she charming? Was she witty? Was she nasty? Was she blah, 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 blah? And it went on and on. And Frank was just kind of disgusted. And somebody came in a few days later and said, what did you do about that? And he said, I checked yes to all of them. And so basically that was Frank. I tried to allow what voices I had access to in there. But I'm not sure what conflict you're talking about to try to resolve.
Well, certainly there are very different points of view about, well, his brother's, you know, about his brother, you know, and
right.
he has his view about his brother, but there are lots of other people who have very right. different points of view about Robert Oppenheimer.
Yeah, so. I didn't go there. I decided that I would write it. I didn't know his brother. I didn't know Robert. So this is a book through my lens about Frank. So I write about Robert as a brother and what he was like as a brother and as the influence. And I really don't get a lot into that. I mean, I borrowed from a lot of wonderful books, but I just tell the very bare naked story because it's been told so many times. That was my decision, just to do it.
And, you know, and Barbara, in your case, I mean, famous battles that Frank Gehry has had. We don't get Eli Broad's point of view about Frank Gehry.
I know there were. I thought about all this at one point. There were a couple of interviews that were so wonderful. I wanted to have them be separate. I did an interview with Barry Diller talking about how he and Frank Gehry designed the building in New York. And it was so wonderful. I originally had it as like a box in the book, and I didn't want to bring in that second voice. So I took that story and put it in my introduction. And there was another voice, the head of the Wiseman Museum at the University of Minnesota. And her voice was so wonderful, talking about how people always criticized Geary as building this building that was totally not in context with the land that it was on, but it was in context with the water, which was right next to the land, because she felt that the building just reflected the water and reflected the sun. And I finally condensed her into a paragraph leading in. But the difference with mine, I think it was partly biography, and it was also that I have a great interest in creativity and how art happens. And in a sense, I actually also used Frank Geary as my exemplar of how art happens, so that my questions were less about the stuff with Eli Broad than they were, okay, how long does it take to do a drawing? Okay, now when you bring in the model, what do you do next? So my questions were more, tell us how it goes. What goes through your head? What, you know, what painting did you see that in this cover of the book is based on a building he did in Dusseldorf, is based on a Giorgio Morandi painting, partially on a Renaissance painting. I mean, I think stuff like that's so fascinating. I just let him go on that.
You know, can I just add to that for a sec? And I won't answer the next question. But
No.
Now that I've had just a minute to think about it, because I was pushed into looking at the relationship between the brothers. So Robert Oppenheimer was the father of the atomic bomb, and then he was basically destroyed by politics. And one of the things that Frank didn't talk about him much, but when he did, it was with great sadness. And one of the things really stayed with me, when his brother was stripped from power, I mean, he was on first-name basis with, you know, presidents, everybody, and then he was a nobody, Frank always used to talk about beware of the applause factor. And he never quite understood why his brother was so enamored of being a big shot. And that was one of the reasons that he fell, while Frank actually blossomed, which is a much darker history, because he never confused who he was as a person with his public persona. So that was a huge difference that mm-hmm. turned out to be a really guiding point. So thanks for giving me a minute to think about it.
Well, I think one of the things that's striking about your subjects, which is that Frank Geary, like Frank Oppenheimer, celebrity comes late in his life, as opposed to Joe Papp, who happens quite young. And so that each of them has a different relationship to celebrity. Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of, I mean, Frank Geary is 54, 55 when he's, you know, he has his first, there's the first museum show, and he suddenly becomes a kind of international celebrity. But for the first 20 years of his work, of his career, he's not known by almost anybody in the public.
I know. I mean, the main thing that thrust him into attention was the house he built for himself in Santa Monica. And then after he won the Walt Disney competition for the concert hall, that was in 1988, and it took
almost as long as Ken's book.
It is. It didn't open until 2003, and in the meantime, he did the Guggenheim Bilbao, and that's what pushed him into everything, because it was considered, you know, the most important architectural commission ever. But he told me, and I believe it's in the book, that he was really glad that fame came so late. Because he then could, you know, just if he didn't like doing it anymore, he could just sort of walk away. But he didn't. He said a lot of friends he had who became famous when they were young had to deal with it. Or, you know, think about, if you think, I think it was David Mamet who said after he won the Pulitzer, he was so worried, like, what kind of play is he going to write next? You know?
Well, in fact, there are two examples, I think, of playwrights in your book, Ken, who never write anything again after winning the Pulitzer.
It's true, and you know that one of them said, I think it might have been Jason Miller, you know, who won the Pulitzer for A Championship Season, said, you know, you can't imagine what it's like to sit down at the typewriter and think to yourself, this is the next play by the man who won the Pulitzer Prize. You know, it's just, it was crippling. You know.
But to go back to celebrity for a second, which is, it seems to me, Joe Papp uses celebrity in a very different way. He very much uses his public persona to leverage.
Exactly.
You know, it's not so much power, but for things for his own institution.
Exactly. No, Joe was very, you know, he was like a laser. You know, he was, I mean, people said all kinds of things about him. Nobody ever said he was insincere and that he didn't believe in the things he professed to believe in. He really believed in theater. He really believed in theater for masses of people, free Shakespeare, the public theater. And he used everything as a means towards that. And he used his celebrity as a way to get city funds to make this theater happen. And he was just like this about it. And it was amazing. And he really was good at it. And, you know, he would fundraise that way. You know, he's a great fundraiser. Someone gave him a check for $10,000, and he said, "You should be ashamed to give me so little money." I mean, he did things that you can't believe anyone would did, but he could do it because he believed. He was not, you know, he had no skeletons in his closet. He believed.
Frank Oppenheimer, who also creates this extraordinary institution, seems slightly different in that way, which is that he is a larger-than-life character, but it's a different larger-than-life character than Joe Papp.
Yeah, well, I think Frank was really surprised at what he managed to create from a kind of a dark and unhappy background in many ways, and trying to do something really about the fact that we live in a nuclear world, and what can you do to make people comfortable with understanding difficult things. For people who've never been to the Exploratorium, it's 90,000 square feet of the most amazing science toys and art. Most of it's made by artists, and it's just incredible. And he made it out of nothing. And the subtitle of the book refers to when you'd tell Frank, "Frank, you can't do that. You know, it's the real world." And he'd say, "It's not the real world. It's a world we made up, and we can make it differently." And I remember after The Nova came out of him, I think it was in the early 1980s, and suddenly he's famous. He was like this little kid. He'd go in there and go, "Wow, I can't believe." I mean, he just couldn't believe that it had actually happened. So he never stopped being a little, even when he was dying. He was, you know, he had cancer, and he had radiation therapy, and he had people wheel his wheelchair back and forth from some exhibit that had a Geiger counter so he could see how radioactive he was. But he just never stopped playing until...
Well, it seems to be one of the things that all of you have accomplished in your books, which is that what any journalist will tell you is that writing about institutions is perhaps one of the hardest things to do. And yet you each bring, you know, institutions. In Geary's case, it's complicated because it's mostly the institution of his own studio and the institutions that he actually builds. But you bring these institutions to life. And one of the ways you do it, Casey, is that you are, you know, you're not there exactly at its creation, but you're almost there at its creation. Talk a little bit about the institution and talk about what the challenges were to convey it to an audience that you had to assume had never been there.
Yeah. Well, I actually went back to the 1973, I think, cover story I wrote for the Saturday Review, believe it or not, about the Exploratorium, and I looked at my notes so I could see what the place looked like to me when I first walked in there, this, whoa, what is this place? And then I went back, and the last chapter is going back and having almost the same experience. But the institutional growth was really hard because, you know, as I say, it was Frank and his hippies, basically. Bunch of MacArthur fellows came out of there. I mean, but it was very homegrown. And when it got to be a multi-million dollar institution, copied all over the world, which it is today, you know, institutions change. And so I had to decide, am I going to stop with Frank's death? Or am I going to talk about what happened to the institution? And that was difficult. I decided to stop with Frank because I really didn't want to get into that. You know, it just changes when you become an institution. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And Barbara, it seems to me one of the purposes, you know, of your book is to talk about creativity, but which is that architecture by its nature is a collaborative art. And so, you know, one of the things that you do in your book is talk about how the studio works. Talk a little bit about how Geary's thinking about this, you know, how he thinks about this. There's that wonderful quote from one of his colleagues who refers to it as creating a culture of possibility. Can you talk about the culture of possibility that he creates?
Yeah, the culture of possibility. The quote referred to an architect who had worked in Geary's office said that when people asked him what he thought was the best thing that Geary had created, he would say the office. Because what that office did was it really gave people a sense of possibility and that no idea was too crazy. And if you look at the history of a great many young architects coming up now, I'd say from 30, even into their 50s, there are people who went through that Geary office because so many people, after a few years, he would sit down with them. He'd say, well, you want to stay here any longer? It's time for you to move on. You know, and they would. I mean, a couple people stayed. His two key people had been with him forever. But so many of the others moved on. And if you walk through the office now, the group there is so young. And each time I'd go back, I mean, this book took about 4 years. Most of the conversations are conversations we had over the last 4 years. But a lot of them were spurred by conversations he and I had had, like you did, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So I have been visiting that office of his for more than 20 years, and it's rarely the same people. It's a whole new group of young people.
And do you think it's fair to say that, you know, as a metaphor, that, you know, Disney Hall and Bilbao and, you know, the American Center in Paris and all of these extraordinary buildings are also sort of there to create cultures of possibility?
Well, I think that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw, there was a Simpsons episode.
Yes.
A very
famous Simpsons
episode. And he loves to talk about this episode. It was apparently where Marge Simpson had sent a letter off to Frank Gehry asking him if he would design a concert hall for Springfield. And he gets this letter and he goes, I don't have time for this. Crunches up the letter, tosses it in the trash, looks at the trash can, pulls the letter out. And it's all shaped just like Disney Hall. And he holds it up, and he says, Frank, you're a genius. So he loved this. And in fact, I told this story when I did an interview with him at the New York Public Library, and I got the punchline wrong. I said, you know, something like, boy, that's terrific. And Gehry said, wait a minute, that's not what I said on the show. I said, Frank Gehry, you're a genius.
To contrast that, Joe Papp, you know, I think also creates a culture of possibility, but he fires his, you know, his closest, you know, aide, confidant, his co-creator. When people leave, it is a personal, you know, it is a personal affront to him. It's a very different culture of possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's true, but really, I think even the people he fired would say that their most exciting time of their life, their most creative time, was when they worked for him. There was something in him that enhanced other people's creativity. I mean, and being a producer is a very tricky thing because you think, well, anyone could do this. It's the person with the money. It's the organizer. It's not a creative job. And for Joe, it was a creative job. And, he got, as you said, you know, plays out of people who never wrote great plays again. There are so many actors like George C. Scott, Meryl Streep, Martin Sheen, Barbara mentioned. You know, he gave them their first job. You'd say, well, anyone would hire George C. Scott. Well, no one did. You know, it was Joe, you know. So he saw something in people, even though at some point he dropped them and made them crazy. But they all would say that this was the best time I ever had creatively.
And it's certainly true of the people at the Exploratorium, right?
Well, yeah, I was going to say there, and I read an interview with Warren Bennis and Frank Gehry, and I was looking and say, wow, this is Frank. The way the Exploratorium ran was, we used to say it was an anarchy, and Frank was the anarch. And that's pretty much the way it went. And somebody had told me he could never even get a job anyplace today. But Warren Bennis, who's our great leadership guru at USC, said, no, actually, he was on the forefront, that flat hierarchy of creative genius, and then everybody, no rules. There was a rule against having rules. It sounded like, from Bennis's article, from the conversation, that Gehry had much the same kind of shop. Hire the people you want, be a visionary, and then just let them go.
Yeah, let them come in with whatever crazy idea they had.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things about, you know, writing that everybody knows is that, in fact, it is about excluding as much as it is including. And it's in each of your books, there are things that you've excluded. There is almost nothing in yours about Joe's personal life. I assume that was a conscious decision. What went into that decision?
What into it was that Joe said, we're not talking about my personal life. And that's exactly what happened. But, you know,
What did you say?
But some of it snuck in around the edges. Sometimes he'd say something that kind of snuck in. But, you know, he had a complicated personal life, more so than he really acknowledged. He had the wife that people thought was his first wife was his third wife. Right. There was, when I went back to New York for the book signing, a woman came up to me who looked just like Joe, was a spitting image of Joe. And I said, how do you do? And she said, I'm one of Joe's illegitimate children, you know, and the family had accepted her. It was clear that she was Joe's child. So he had a very messy personal life, didn't want it talked about. But really, it was not only that, it wasn't that he was ashamed of it. I think he just, again, it was that laser focus, the theater, what was good for the theater. It would distract people to hear about that. He wanted the theater front and center. He believed in that. I mean, he was like, you know, a religious belief, how much he believed in theater. It was quite something.
And, you know, were there any regrets? I mean, not that you had any choice about this. Were there any regrets that could not be part of the book at any moment when you were working on it?
Not really. The one thing I would have regretted if he had not wanted it was I thought so much of what he became came out of his childhood.
Right.
Came out of how he grew up. He was really just astonishingly poor. Family would move in the middle of the night because they couldn't pay the rent. You know, the kind of poverty that was exceptional. And that made him a young communist, and that gave the theater, that was the drive to make theater for everyone, came from that. And if he would have said, no, we're not talking about that I would have fought about. But his marriages, you know, I could see how he didn't want them, and I didn't feel I had, compelling arguments to put them in.
And Casey, there's a similar aspect in your book too, which is that Frank Oppenheimer also had a messy personal life, and you allude to it, but you do not go into it.
Right, because, again, it really wasn't my Frank, but it also didn't get to who he was. In the same way, I talk about his childhood a lot, exactly the opposite. He became a communist, but grew up in a very wealthy family. But the communists were the only ones fighting racism and unemployment and so forth. But, he had mistresses, and I say that. And I only learned about it at the very end of his life, even though I'd worked with him for 15 years. So it wasn't part of my Frank.
Is that horrible scene you refer to as he's dying?
Oh, yeah, as he was dying. And this is when I realized. It was an actress, actually, in New York.
She actually worked for Joe Papp, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right, really?
No, I just made that up. So.
Well, it's Mabu Mayim.
I wanted to tie everything together here.
So. No, but that wasn't. So.
No, that was another group.
So it was not Joseph Papp. But at the end of his life, this girlfriend shows up. Frank is now remarried, and, his son, Michael, has to carry his father to see his girlfriend. And, of course, it was extremely disruptive for the family. And for Michael and Judy, the two children who grew up exiled on a Colorado cattle ranch, and, because of the communist banning. He was a pretty angry father. That was a really hard life and a very hard time they went through. So I do put in Judy's and Mike's, and I do put that in, but it wasn't the essence. It was just like this. The childhood was important. The atomic bomb was important. His brother was important. But the mistresses, it only at the end, it just didn't seem to impact.
I didn't do it either. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I thought the childhood was really important, because Geary grew up poor as well, and he and his sister would take turns sharing. One of them got the Murphy bed, the one that went up in the wall, and the other one got the couch. And they had this little tiny shabby apartment, and he didn't have any money at all, until he was like in his 50s. He was the entire staff of his firm for a long time. But I didn't put his wife in because he asked me not to. He said, or he didn't ask me not to. He told me that she would prefer if I didn't get into her very much. And she's very private, and there was nothing to say. He referred to her in kind ways whenever.
His best client. He refers to her as his best
client.
Yes,
right.
About deciding the house, yeah.
Right, because, but I mean, like, he was talking about how they met. He told me all these stories, how they met, how they fell in love and everything. But it didn't work in terms of the general narrative, and I wanted to make it like a really good story. I wanted things to kind of follow one after the other. And when he was talking about her as a good client was when she went out and found this house in Santa Monica, and let him do what he wanted.
And what all three of you done is totally against the grain of contemporary culture, you know, which is that, which is that the personal and all of the messy personal life is what most people are interested in, not the work.
They're wrong.
Yeah, only if it affects the work. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's People Magazine. Right, I mean, you can have everything. You can go read that.
I'd like to go back to this idea that I sort of began part of this conversation with, which is about the kind of the effect of the West and the West Coast on all three of your subjects. And you know, one of the most surprising things that I discovered in your book, Kit, is that Joe Papp was here for the 9 months, and this was in some very real way a turning point in his life. It's easy to mythologize Los Angeles' effect on him, and it's, not suffering from the burden of history. But can you talk about that and how he viewed that period and how he viewed Los Angeles?
Yeah, well, I think it is kind of a parallel with the not having the burden of history. It was a place of possibility for him. It was a place where things could happen, where he wasn't tied down to his horrible past, on the East Coast where he was so poor. He had, one of the things that amazed me was that he had started doing this theatrical stuff in the Navy, and Bob Fosse had been one of his sailors on the ship. I thought he made this up when he told me this, but it turned out to be true. But, he came out here almost on a whim, and, he stumbled upon the Actors Lab, and he, as you say, he just discovered himself. He discovered what he was good at. But I think there was something about the West, about Los Angeles, that made him feel there was a sense of possibility that he could try it out.
Well, he's that wonderfully articulate about driving convertibles up and down.
Yeah.
You can't do that in Manhattan.
He didn't want to stay here, but I think it was a key moment in his life, absolutely.
And talk about kind of the West, because it's not just the West Coast. It's, New Mexico and Colorado and the Bay Area for Frank Oppenheimer.
Well, 1968 was quite a time to arrive in San Francisco to want to do something new. So, the word just got out that there was this crazy guy in this place, in the Palace of Fine Arts, and artists from all over, people, Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth Catalog, John Cage, musicians, and they would just do completely crazy things, whatever they wanted to. And one of the things that amused me going back, there were all kinds of stories about what musicians and artists did in the place, and one of them involved a guy who put some kind of electrical devices in all these mirrors, and he played music, and then they, crashed to the floor, and it was all just crazy. 30 years later, I go back, and the first thing I see in the machine shop is a woman is conducting music and with lathes and saws and drills and so forth, so that actually, in some ways, not much had changed. But certainly, being in San Francisco in the '60s with that complete openness and everybody trying everything certainly helped make that possible.
And Frank Gehry is, in all sorts of ways, the kind of living embodiment of Los Angeles.
He came here in '47 with his family. He was 17 years old, and he got a job as a truck driver, didn't know what he was going to do. And at that time, he would drive this truck making deliveries out to the valley. He was fascinated by the valley. And what he loved about Los Angeles was that there was not just a burden of history, but there were no formal rules. He could do anything. And so he loved that. He said he just sensed that there was, we all use these words of, the possibility. He said that
Los Angeles was an exploratorium.
It was. It was an exploratorium, and it was kind of a place where you could reinvent yourself, which they did. They changed your name from Goldberg to Gehry. I mean, it was just a totally free and open, kind of almost Old West town when he got here in the 40s.
I just want to say, I think that one thing Frank said about rules was actually very profound. I mean, I get joked about, kidded about this because I really hate rules. But he said the reason you make rules is so you don't have to think about situations individually one-on-one, and that's why he thought they were really insidious. And I think this idea of being able to break out of that so that you have to look at everything as it is and not as some pat general thing.
And yet there's a paradox, and then we'll end on this, which is that each of them have towering, I think it's fair to say, egos. Each of them, are the anarchs in their anarchy. I mean, there was no question There's no question who rules that studio. There's no question who ruled Exploratorium, and there's absolutely no question who ruled the public theaters. So that they did this paradoxical thing, which is create these cultures of possibility, created these places with, well, I'm not sure public theater had no rules, but at the same time, there were people who were forcefully making decisions, and they live with this paradox every day of their lives.
Well, I think Joe and I, probably these, you know, Frank and both Franks felt this way. You know, Joe felt he knew best, you know. I mean, he felt that he really was the person who was best equipped to make these decisions. But, you know, he was very much in charge. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is when I, you know, after the book came out, at signings of things, I would meet people who worked for him, and they always referred to him, when they talk about him, they'd say, I worked for Mr. Papp. He insisted on being called Mr. Papp by the people who worked there. And it's such an ingrained habit that they still say that. You know, so he was very, very much in charge and made no bones about it.
Huh. Frank Abbanon was almost funny, exactly the opposite in a way from his brother, who was, and people who believed in expertise, and experts should make decisions. Frank thought that the best decisions came when all the people were involved and that everybody should be involved in making decisions. So it was a really difficult place to work because, for example, there was a story about trying to decide what to do about some flies. And you know, it ended, I mean, it was a two-hour discussion about was flypaper humane. And, you know, Frank really would respect everybody's opinion. But yes, he did.
In the end, he made the decision. He killed the flies.
Yes, and he enforced that way of doing things also. Right, so, right. Yeah.
Well, Frank Gehry works in an office that has glass on three sides.
And no flies.
But in the middle, he has moved now several times, but the actual studio in which he works inside the master studio has not changed one bit. It's got two chairs that he built, and it's got glass on three sides so he can see what's going on and people can see him. And he is constantly at 81, jumping up, running around the room to talk to everybody, to kind of get an opinion on something. And collaboration, he actually talked about collaboration as a way of jumping off a cliff with others. You know? So, and the client as the greatest collaborator of all.
Yeah. So. It was interesting. I mean, Joe was really actually, you know, very collaborative. You know, I mean, I say all these people loved working with him while they were working with him. You know, he empowered them and believed in them in a way no one else did. And, you know, one of the things that's always interesting is that so many of the plays that he championed that became enormous hits, like Hair, A Chorus Line, Normal Heart, No Place to Be Somebody, nobody wanted these plays. It wasn't like he fought people off and, you know, snatched these plays. People thought he was out of his mind. But he believed in these plays, and he believed in the people. And so he was in his own way. You know, he was, as you say, it's a paradox. He was autocratic and collaborative at the same time.
Well, on that paradox, let us open up questions to the floor. So, do we have a microphone? The microphone is back there, and we will begin up front here.
It's obvious these three are really heroes. The question I have, did each one of them have a hero who they look to?
That's an interesting question. You know, the person that Joe talked about, I think, with the most respect was a teacher he had in high school, a woman named Eulalie Spence, who had been a Harlem Renaissance poet and had just gotten caught up, you know, couldn't make a living and ended up teaching. And she's the person who introduced him to Shakespeare. She's the person who fixed his Brooklyn accent and said that he could speak better. And that's the person that I think I heard him talk about with the most respect.
Yeah, and I think in Frank's case, it was Niels Bohr and that the group of physicists who were so philosophical that when physics changed to become more about technology, he was very disappointed because it had been about art and philosophy and also doing good for humankind. So Einstein, which a lot of people don't know, thought it was more important to share wealth, to have peace. I mean, he was a pacifist. He wasn't even allowed to talk to people who were working on the atomic bomb, even though he came up with the equations. So this idea that being a scientist meant that you were working for a better world was very deeply ingrained. So it was people like Einstein and Niels Bohr of that generation, yeah.
Well, for Frank Gehry, it was Le Corbusier. And Gehry was a student at the Harvard School of Design. He didn't fit in at all. He was totally unhappy, and he eventually dropped out. But while he was there, there were a lot of people there who were very influenced by Corbusier and who were his disciples. And so there was an art exhibition at Harvard the one year that Gehry was there, and these were paintings by Corbusier, and it gave Gehry the chance to see that Corbusier was working out his architectural theories in his paintings. And Gehry said even then, when he was a college kid, he knew that those were not great paintings, that he couldn't take them to New York and sell them on Madison Avenue. But it gave him the notion, why couldn't he draw and in the same way work out some of his architectural problems?
Since all of these three figures grew up in Jewish households, could you talk a little bit about how they're breaking away from that or how they were shaped by that a little bit, what effect that had on their later work? The belief system as well as maybe just the culture itself.
Well, I think Joe, though, it was again one of his earliest examples of being kind of a communist and rebelling. You know, his father was very poor and the very religious, but there was no place for his father in bigger temples. You know, his father felt out of place. Joe always felt the kind of the class structure system of organized Judaism in New York, and he rebelled against that. He loved his father, and to see his father feel bad and made little of and not fit into these fancy temples. Joe went to some of these fancy temples because another unlikely thing about him, he was a boy soprano, you know, and he sang in choirs during High Holy Day services, and his father would come, and everyone treated his father badly, and it infuriated Joe.
Well, Frank's father also, you know, came over without speaking any English. He was very poor, but got very wealthy during World War I. But he helped found the Ethical Culture Society in New York. So this was secular Judaism.
And the real difference also is German Jews versus Eastern European Jews. You
know? Well,
Joe was definitely
the difference
European.
Between 1880. Coming over in 1880
right.
and 1900.
Right. But it was very important for them to find a moral, ethical core that was not related to religion, because Frank was absolutely an atheist and loved to debate with people. He didn't understand why people wouldn't talk about that. But the fact that his father was one of the founders of the Ethical Culture Society, and he and his brother both grew up in that, it was a kind of different substitute religion, different way to get it, same thing, so...
Well, Gehry came from his grandparents fled Poland, and he and his father had some issues. So his grandparents really raised him, his mother's parents, and his grandfather had a hardware store, and he would go when he was a child, and he would help his grandfather in the store fix clocks. Hammer out things, and they would sit there and they would talk Talmud all day. And he said the thing he learned, you know, all the questions, you know, why is the sky blue? Why does the day end and night comes? Were things that instilled in him a great curiosity. And then also with his grandmother, he would go with his grandmother every week to buy fish at the market in Toronto where he grew up. And they would bring the carp home, and they'd put it in the bathtub. And he would play with the carp, you know, all week. And then on Friday, no carp. And they'd have their gefilte fish at dinner. And he said it was only when he was older that he realized the connection between his little thing that he was playing with. And then also where they lived in Toronto, my favorite story about his grandparents was his grandmother would take him with her when she would buy wood chips, or she would get wood chips for the stove. And so they'd give her all the wood, and then they'd have like the scraps, and she'd bring home a whole bag of scraps. And they'd get home, and she'd go onto the linoleum floor, and she'd pour all these wood blocks and all these wood scraps on the floor. And little Frank and his grandmother would sit there and play with them. And they'd build houses, and they'd build cities, and they'd build bridges. And later on, when he was choosing a career, he tried to think about what was the most fun he'd had in his whole life. And it was sitting on the floor with his grandmother, building. You know, so...
Back to the phrase that was used a few times, the burden of history, and maybe challenge that in a nice way if I could. It seems like it's a theme that we hear a lot in Southern California. And maybe it fit Frank Gehry's situation when he was getting started, but I think architecture had a pretty good history in the 20th century in Los Angeles, and maybe film did too. And I'd just like to get your response to that. I personally think there's probably no better place to study history than 20th century L.A. It's more robust and dynamic than really any other place that I can think of, and I'd like to get the panel's view on that.
I guess I'm the one who introduced this idea, so I should take some responsibility for it. I think, I don't want to speak for Frank Gehry, I think partly what this idea is about is not that L.A. doesn't have any history, which of course is a silly idea, but that that this is a place that's sort of being created before our eyes, and that it has the possibility of being a meritocracy, and that your last name and where you went to school matters far less than it does in the Northeast, and that it's also the least European of American cities. And so I think that's partly what the idea is, and partly what all of them were reacting to. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense. So I'll throw that out for Frank and Barbara and Casey to see if that's close to what Pap was responding to and what Frank Gehry was responding to. And obviously, San Francisco is a whole different, because it's a very East Coast, in many ways, modeled very much as a Mediterranean city. So.
No, even I think, you know, I mean, it just seemed more open to him here, I think, especially after growing up in the constricted, you know, East Coast and spending World War II on these boats, which were also very constricted. He liked the light. He liked the feeling of freedom. You know, I think that's what he responded to.
It's that, what Barbara said about, you know, their sense of having no rules, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, I mean, for Frank Gehry, there were two things here, the wood and the light. And he said, you know, he's growing up here. Or he's he's 17. He's in LA City College, and then eventually at USC, and studying architecture. And he said what he learned to do was he would learn from people like John Lautner, or some of the people who were teaching at the University of Southern California Architecture School who had been to Japan, and there was a whole sense of wood and light and lightness. And those were things that you could work with. You were a kid. He had never been to Europe. He didn't know. He said if he'd seen Corbusier when he was very young, he wouldn't have been able to do anything with that information. But this was something he could work with. And I think that a lot of the things you're seeing now that have been built up came out of that time of experimentation for people like Gehry, you know, during the middle part of the last century.
With Oppenheimer, it was very different. He pushed off history because here were a lot of the people who worked on the atomic bomb were pacifists and, Jewish intellectuals from all over the place, interested in culture. And suddenly Hitler, that looks like the whole world is being taken over by fascism. They feel like they don't have any choice. They develop this horrible weapon, and then unbeknownst to most of them, it suddenly dropped on pristine cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, kept not bombed so they could see the damage. And the horror of that and the, you know, what have we done and what do we do now really is what drove him to build the Exploratorium and try to make sure that everybody was included and that we didn't listen to authority experts, that everybody should be involved in this process. So it wasn't so big, I guess it wasn't so much of a burden as a reason.
Early in the interview, there was a little dialogue between Kit and Kenneth about how, Kenneth, you used these narratives that you got from people to make points that it was going to be hard to do, but you somehow managed to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad you know what I'm talking about. So I'd like some little insight into that, please.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I don't know that people think of journalism necessarily as a creative art. I mean, Frank Gehry, architects are creative. But I mean, this is something that I can do. You know, I mean, I just have an ability to do that. I look at material, I organize it, I get a sense of what goes with what. I couldn't tell you where that comes from, but I look at the stuff and I say, okay, this can lead to that, and this can come in after that. And, you know, it's just something that it's partly intuitive, it's partly years of doing it. It's, you know, is no real simple way for me to tell you how it happens, but that's kind of what goes on, you know, and I just, it's partly it's just organization. I started with 10,000 pages of transcript, you know, and it's a lot. Yeah, and I made endless outlines, outlines inside of outlines inside of outlines, big outlines, small outlines, book-length outlines, chapter-length outlines, section outlines. And, you know, it's just a huge amount of work. And, you know, but it's something that I enjoyed. I don't want to make it sound like a terrible thing. It was really exciting and, again, creative to try and get these pieces to fit together in a meaningful way. Yeah.
We're in Hollywood, and frequently the biographies are tell it all, and what each of you in your respective way have really pointed out the importance of selectively not telling it all. Would you comment?
Everyone likes to tell a story. And so when you tell a story, the best story is one that kind of hews toward, you know, the beginning, a middle, and an end, I think, actually, for myself, a beginning, a middle, and an end. So if you're telling a story, you're going to take out stuff that doesn't belong. And someone else can write that book. You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, with Frank Gehry, if somebody else wants to go into his private life or whatever, fine. That particular book that I was writing was about a man who creates, how he does it, the impact it has. That was the story.
I agree with Barbara and Ken. Because it's the organizing, the storytelling, you want to do a narrative. You just want to tell a great story. So what takes away from that or seems irrelevant falls out.
I mean, we just place such a premium sometimes in this culture on the salacious that it's hard to actually say, well, it doesn't always fit, you know. And I think in all of our cases, we just felt it didn't really have a part.
One last question. Yes.
This is for Mr. Turan. I've until I read your book, I thought that there were two books that were really incredible about the theater and the creative process. And one is The Fervent Years by Harold Clurman and Moss Hart's Act One. And I think that you captured beautifully the idea of how you put a theater together and how it works. And it's a lot more chaotic than people would think. And I had two questions for you. One was, I just was blown away in the introduction when you set forth the fact that you wrote this whole thing, you wrote the whole book, and you took it, or somebody presented it to Joseph Papp, and at that moment in his life, he said, I don't want this published. And I just... And you go on to describe your personal feelings about that. And I was wondering, did you ever get a chance to make a pitch to him to have this book published at that time, or was it just done through an intermediary? That's my first question. My second question is, I felt that the book was a combination of both an autobiography and a biography, because you have so much of Papp just telling about his life in the theater. And I just wondered if that was at all an issue for you in dealing with the book. So those are the two questions I had.
Okay, so I can't remember. They're good questions, but I can't.
How did you react? Did you ever plead on the book's behalf directly to Joe Papp?
Well, you know, it was not Joe's way to go through intermediaries. Joe told me this himself. You know, he called me to his apartment and he said, we're not doing this. You know, we're not doing it. He didn't really tell me why, But he told me face to face, he said, we're not going forward. You know, and it was, I mean, as I say in the introduction, I mean, maybe I don't say in the introduction, it was like someone died. I mean, it was, I couldn't look at this book. I couldn't even look at the manuscript for years. I mean, I kept it. I knew where it was. I didn't open it up and look at it. I didn't want my friends to read it because it would be too depressing for them to tell me it was a good book. I mean, it was just a nightmare. But, you know, I knew it was good, and that's why I persevered, because I just felt that it was valuable. But, you know, the interesting thing was I had a lot of anger towards the publisher who caved in. I never was angry at Joe about this. What he did was so in character with the way he had acted with so many people that I had half expected it. And, you know, I think if I had been angry at him, I never could have brought it back. You know, I always respected him. And in fact, when I did bring it back, when I did read it again after all these years, what really struck me was that his voice was one of the strongest voices. When I talked to him, I didn't like his voice as much as I did after 20 years. Other people seemed more exciting. But his voice, his words, really stood the test of time more than anyone else's. So I was happy to have that much of it of him in there. And, you know, like I said, I never was an issue because I really never was angry. Maybe I should have been angry at him. But he was so being himself when he killed this book that I just couldn't be mad at him.
Well, thank you very much for coming, and please thank our panelists.
Thank you. Thank you. Kit. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.